This is the Roaring Elephant Podcast, and here I am once more with my co-host and a special guest.
I'm a co-host and a special guest?
No, you're not a special guest.
That didn't take long.
We're here once more with Sally Radwan to talk about the ethics and AI, and we're going to get into things like accountability this time around. So, you ready to go, Jan?
Nobody saw anything. Nobody can prove it was me.
I will hold you accountable. Anyway, with that, let's dive in. Yeah. I mean, so we've talked a little bit about kind of bias and fairness. Maybe the next topic is more about the privacy and data protection side of things. So, like, protecting user rights, you know, ensuring that there are appropriate data handling practices and respecting kind of privacy rights. Like, how do you think this needs to be thought of within, you know, the folks that are developing in the AI world at the moment?
That's also a very big topic. And I think some of the responsibility, of course, is on the developers or the scientists. And I fully agree with Jan that they should be called scientists because it is a scientific process. So I think because it is a scientific process, we need to put the same guardrails that we have for data that is being used for science. And if you're using medical data, for example, there are very, very strong restrictions on how the data can be, should be anonymized, how you shouldn't be allowed to trace it to the target person, even through sophisticated analysis and deduction methods and so on and so forth. So there should be that. There should also be the awareness instilled in the people themselves who build these models, to not take any shortcuts and to be well aware of the impact this can have on people at large, including themselves. Like, you could be affected, your family could be affected, your friends could be affected. So let's be responsible about this. But then, of course, there's an institutional part that needs to happen in terms of legislation and in terms of having oversight over the entire process. And this is where things also tend to be very inconsistent around the world. I think one of the things, and this leads us to the wider discussion on AI and its enablers, and AI as an amplifier of digital divides, really. Because when I led AI for Egypt, I used to always get asked about the AI race. And I always said, it's not a race. It can't be a race because we're not all starting from the same point. You have countries that have a long history of having lots of enablers in place and having, you know, solid legislative frameworks, solid data protection laws, in fact, data architectures and corpora of data that you can use for training, reasonable structures for research and development and processes to move from R&D to deployment to the wider market. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you have countries in this world where illiteracy rates are close to 70 or 80%. So compare the pyramids, right? So in the one hand, on the one end of the spectrum, you're paying basically at the top of the pyramid, tweaking the niches of, okay, so how is this going to affect us today? And, you know, how many models should we build per year? And how is this going to affect our quality of life, kind of thing? All of which are very important questions, of course. But then you've got the other end, where you first have to teach people how to read and write. Then you have to teach them about mathematics. Then you have to teach them about computers. And you have to teach them about programming and data structures and algorithms, and you have to install digital infrastructures and be able to even collect data, let alone govern it properly and manage it properly and anonymize it and make it available for training and so on and so forth. So it's not the case that bias always happens because we were, you know, negligent or didn't do our homeworks properly or wanted to move too fast or had even malicious intents. It's because in many cases it's really, really difficult, almost impossible to do. And the issue of privacy and data is kind of the same thing. In many countries of the world, data legislation, data protection laws don't exist. So if you sit in California and you're developing this really cool new AI application that you want to unleash on the world because you want to see and you want to test it and you want reach and ads and everything else, how do you protect the person in rural, you know, sub-Saharan Africa who doesn't have, who maybe has a mobile signal and a smartphone, but they don't have data protection laws in their country to protect how their data is handled and dealt with. So it's a very, very big and complex topic. But at the very least, if we don't have those institutional frameworks, then at least individual responsibility needs to kick in. And that, of course, then is on the developers of the models.
Mm. I mean, we see like even like dual standards within sort of what happens today. Like you see, because Europe generally speaking has things like GDPR that exist and a strong idea of privacy and data protection, the rules and regulations, and indeed penalties around if you break those things, you know, a lot of what happens in, for example, a lot of the US companies, stuff gets rolled out there far and ahead of when it arrives in Europe. But does that also mean that there are situations occurring where, I don't know, almost like models or things are being experimented on in areas where there's even less data protection that exists? Is that happening today?
Oh, yes.
Wow.
I mean, the pharmaceutical industry taught us how to do that, right?
Yeah.
If you have too many restrictions on where you can test your drugs, you go where there are no restrictions.
Yeah. That's a scary thought. Yeah. Okay. So you mentioned sort of personal, you know, sort of when there are no sort of restrictions, there needs to be some sort of personal accountability. I mean, accountability and responsibility as a whole is another kind of big area here where, you know, making sure that there are clear lines of responsibility for AI systems and their consequences, including, you know, how you deal with the redress of something. How does this change when you're thinking about, yeah, when you're thinking about AI development?
How does it change?
How should it change? Like how should people be thinking about accountability? Mm-hmm. Should they just like rely on the policymakers to have done all the heavy lifting for them? And they can just, you know, offload their brain to, oh, as long as I'm following all the regulations, I must be fine?
That's a really good question. And I think these are the types of questions we should be grappling with. You know, sitting where I do now, and I've been involved in a lot of the kind of global intergovernmental conversations around AI ethics and how do we roll it out and how do we make it practical. And so there are many ways to answer your questions. So let me try to tackle it from a couple of angles. there's the angle of what is the role of the multilateral process, for example. So things like the UN. And the truth is, it's very, very hard to get 193 countries to agree on something. So it has to be the minimum of, you know, the least common denominator, essentially, of super, super common sense stuff that no one will really argue with. Like, you know, being kind to people is nice, kind of thing. It's difficult to get much more sophisticated than that, because then you'll get differences. And sometimes the differences, in fact, most of the time, the differences are for very good and understandable reasons. So you can't really argue with why a certain country has certain priorities, right? So it's very, very difficult to get in the UN process to something that is binding to everyone. We've tried it a few times. It's actually succeeded in a few times, like in the Paris Agreement, for example, on climate change and various other domains. But it's a very, very difficult process. And as you see now, it also changes with time. So not just because everyone signed onto it doesn't mean they will stay signed onto it. So the multilateral process is very, very hard and also very slow. So by the time you get to something usable, the technology has already leapfrogged you. And I always use the example of, you know, when I was in the expert group that UNESCO convened to draft the ethics recommendation on AI that was launched in 2021. We spent 2 years almost working on it. And it was a group of, you know, fairly distinguished AI experts. And not one of us mentioned generative AI. It just wasn't a thing then. So if we knew, if we had seen it coming in the way, of course we knew about, you know, large language models were already kind of in their infancy, but no one could anticipate that they would explode this quickly and in the way they did. And this was a non-binding recommendation that just very nicely says, well, dear governments, you may want to be careful about this thing because it's important. So imagine the difference between that and binding legislation or rules that should now govern something like generative AI. We're miles away from that. So this is one way of looking at it. But the other way, of course, is also to look at it, going back to the techies versus non-techies conundrum. You know, at the end of the day, it's a world driven by capitalism. And it's an industry. There are competitive advantages and there's a lot of money on the table. So it's very difficult to get the private sector, especially if they operate in an environment that is quite liberal when it comes to protection and that sees any kind of legislation or regulation as stifling innovation and entrepreneurship. And then all of a sudden start imposing guardrails on everyone. But then, of course, to be able to survive in the global landscape, that also includes the EU that says, oh, no, 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 no. We like innovation, but we also like our human rights, right? So to resolve that, you then get these things in big tech that say, oh, no, no, we have our guardrails and we even publish some of them. So trust us that we're enforcing them really, really strongly on our operations. But we really can't be part of a global thing that tells us what to do. I mean, come on, that would completely stifle our innovation. So to address all of that, and again, that's a very, very hard problem. And to this day, it's very difficult to get the private sector to sit at the table in a meaningful way and not just for window dressing. That says, how can we resolve this problem together? So that's where I think the grassroots efforts need to come in. And that's where I think public pressure needs to play a role. It's the only way to then get the private sector, but also policymakers, to move a little bit with a little bit more urgency and to address things as they arise and not try to boil the ocean in one big legislation.
You mentioned capitalism, which makes total sense. But I mean, for me, the world is governed by capitalism and paranoia. Because don't forget, governments, even if they do make the laws, the first thing they do next is say, but this official government body can't step outside those laws. So it's also always hard when policymakers have to put laws in place that they don't have to follow themselves, which, yes, I mean, I'm not going to say it's hypocritical. I mean, there's reasons behind it. I know why it's happening, but that is a different dimension as well, which is a bit weird. But even if they are putting laws in place, and even if they say they will adhere to them, how do you check it? How do you control it? Because it's one thing to say you will no longer cross the street when the light is red, but there's not a police agent on every corner of the street to check that. So on the one hand, yes, the legislation that's being made, decided upon, is very weak, let's call it weak, simple, common sense stuff. But if you make it any harder than that, if you can't actually enforce it, does it make sense? And how would we potentially be able to enforce this? Since nobody actually knows how neural networks work, it's a black box, that's the whole idea behind it. You put something in, something comes out, and you don't know. If you know how it works, it's not a neural network, it's a machine learning algorithm. So how can you ever do that? I mean, yeah. How can you make legislation that works?
Absolutely, which is why I don't think legislation is the only answer. It can't be. You almost have to rely on the right principles slowly seeping into the public consciousness to do the right thing. I mean, we're no longer policed when we cross the street when it's red, right? Mm-hmm. In many places, you don't really police, you don't have cameras everywhere that detect theft, and yet not everyone goes and steals things from a supermarket.
Depends where you live these days, but
True. Yeah. But I mean, yes, by and large. And so is it realistic to expect AI to evolve in the same way? And that will somehow eventually all be super conscious of the harms that can arise, that we will all do the right thing. If you look at crossing the roads and stealing from supermarkets, it's taken us a very long time, and it's taken not just legislation, it's taken education, it's taken public awareness, it's taken, you know, parents raising their kids the right way for many, many, many decades and centuries. And still, as you say, we haven't gotten it completely right.
I think personally, one of the best legislation that came out about data protection was the obligation to make public any kind of data breach. Because it's something that if it comes out there was a data breach and you didn't make it public when it happened, then you can get fined. So it's a bit of a retroactive correction at that point. But it forces people or organizations to fall flat on their face, to be ashamed of things. Again, public awareness, you become aware that this thing happens. And that's the reason why I think a Google and a Microsoft and an Amazon are being more reticent at the moment a little bit, because they've had a couple of mini scandals already with things doing strange things. And now they're kind of, from a capitalist point of view, because if we don't look at ethics, it will at some point bite us in the behind. So there is a kind of a roundabout way that they're not enforcing you have to use good data or good protections. No, there's, if it goes wrong, that's fine. Well, it's not fine, but we can accept that it goes wrong, but you have to make it public. And that's where the whole awareness and the public shaming, by for lack of a better word, does work in favor of ethics at that point, I would say.
I fully agree. I think having more transparency around reporting of incidents and how they were dealt with, and frankly, caring a little bit more about it than they do today, because yes, there have been a couple of scandals, but I would argue that communication around them hasn't been strong enough or open enough. And that's what's led to this exaggeration about what they were or how they, what was it, Google having, invented two machine learning algorithms that talk to each other in a language that humans don't understand, or something like that. You know, if you don't communicate about it openly enough and to everyone and in a timely fashion, then of course you open the door for speculation and misinformation and exaggeration, and then it turns into a scandal when it doesn't always have to be. Sometimes there are real scandals and they then need to be properly dealt with. But in some cases, it's, we're experimenting. There are trials and errors. And if we make a mistake, we'll own up to it and we'll fix it. And that, I think, creates a much better environment of trust and allows for better tracking and better learning for all of humanity to then learn how to tackle these things. Because to be honest, legislation can't cover it all because they don't know what they don't know. I mean, how can a policymaker or a legislator sit down and write a law when they don't know what OpenAI is doing every day?
It's
impossible. Yeah. So you will miss things, and it will take you years to develop the most perfect law, and then the next day you'll find something that that you haven't included there.
Yeah. You mentioned sort of earlier on, you mentioned the capitalism and the fact that, private sector not wanting innovation stifled and that side of things. And like it was always amusing to me when it goes back a little bit to your comment around the AI race, that it's only a race for a very small set of folks that are involved here. Elon Musk famously was fully behind the idea to slow down generative AI adoption and investment, because he was very aware that his interests were significantly behind those of OpenAI and others. And now, of course, he's fully behind, all full steam ahead, remove all restrictions, away we go. But you've also got situations, and you mentioned about some of the lowest common denominator for guidelines get it put in place, and be kind to people, it's good, being one of them. Early on there were things like, we won't put our AI models into military devices that can potentially harm or kill people. Turns out, that's now been, we're going to put it in some devices very carefully. It goes back to your comment around capitalism. Like, this is big business. There is a lot of money to be made by those organizations that do successfully capitalize on the military-industrial complex. And while, that might not be at the forefront of what they're talking about, you can guarantee that, behind closed doors, that's a big topic for, the majority of the major providers.
And I think we'd be naive to expect that to change, right? So
yep.
We can't afford to be too idealistic about this. We do live in a world that is driven by capitalism and profit and interests, and we have to deal with that.
And that's it for the second part of our conversation with Sally. Great stuff again. As you noticed, we didn't end with everything, so it's going to be a third part on this one. Look forward to that one next week. Any thoughts from you?
No, just another excellent discussion, excellent conversation. And looking forward to the part three.
In that case, that is all the time we have for today. You can support this podcast, become a Patreon, contribution helps us get guests like Sally, help us ourselves, something like that. Self-help is important. We are on YouTube. You can hit like, subscribe buttons, notification bells, do all the YouTube stuff. Dave still gets ecstatic whenever you do that. And you can still go to our website at www.rolling.org, links to the Patreon page, YouTube page, information on the podcast. Any feedback? Do you like this topic? Let us know. Send an email to podcast@theroaringelf.org. Until next time, my name is ethics really something for me, Jon?
And my name is There Are No Consequences, Dave.
I look forward to talking to you again without consequences next week. Goodbye.
See you then.